You ever meet somebody in your life that you would maybe call, or maybe even family, a character, a person that, you know, just seems to be have a lot of personality, has a great joy for life? And my guest, Frank Fascino, you're not going to know that side of him too much, because when we do the interview, he's pretty straight with it. But man, him and I just crack up when we talk, when I call him during the week or something like that. Frank's got a lot of good stories to tell. Now, we're going to talk about, we talked about the Flatwoods Monster before. This time we're going to talk to something that's very connected to the same thing. We'll kind of go over the Flatwoods Monster if you're not familiar with that, but really going to talk about Shoot 'Em Down. What happened back in 1952, Frank will explain that these alien craft, if you want to call them that, these foreign craft came across our country, and our government gave out orders to bring them down. Some of them came down in West Virginia. That's where the Flatwoods Monster took place, and other parts of the country. Frank did 18 years of research on this and also did some research and trying to find out what happened to the pilots that attempted to shoot some of these craft down. That and more. It is a great pleasure to bring back Frank Fascino Jr.
Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there. Out there. Out there. Out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
He's been on the show before. He is Frank Fascino, the author of a couple of books. He wrote, Shoot 'Em Down. Shoot 'Em Down is one of the books we're going to talk about. Last time you were on, we talked about the other one, the Flatwoods Monster. How you doing, Frank?
Hey, TJ. Good morning.
Now, you're down in Florida, right? Miami Beach? Is that where it is?
No, I'm in Daytona area.
Daytona.
Yeah, right near the Speedway.
Now, you said you had your own little Speedway accident the other day. What was it? You got home, and just like me, you and I were talking about this. You got home and your car just went, right?
Yeah, the power steering pump hose had blown right as I came around the bend and pulled into the driveway. And I looked underneath the car and it was smoking and everything just emptied right out. So I was lucky I got into the neighborhood right in time.
You know, that's the same thing that happened to me the other day. And I saw it as more than luck because there were like little signs, I thought, telling me that my vehicle or something was going to happen. Anyway, Frank's going to tell us about... We're going to talk about Shoot 'Em Down, but maybe we can go back a little bit. People, I don't know if they heard the first interview we did. You wrote a book called The Flatwoods Monster. How did that all come about? Maybe a brief history of that.
My original research started back in 1991. I have some relatives that live in Braxton County, and I started researching some of the anomalies in that area. There was crop circles.
Now, Braxton County's in West Virginia, right?
Yes. Okay. It's basically the central part of the state.
All right.
And I started documenting the crop circle rings and all the different designs in that area.
And that goes back how far?
About 1991.
Is when they started having crop circles show up.
Yes.
Okay.
But then I found out from talking to the locals, you know, as I started researching a little bit more in depth, there had been crop circle rings and all type of weird things going on in that area going back for 30 years.
Mm.
But the stories never came out of the mountains because the people didn't want to talk about it. So I started working with Colin Andrews and with these crop circle rings, and then I started discovering the different UFO sightings that were occurring over that area. So it was turned out what I thought was unusual was not so unusual for those parts. There was a definite history going back.
Quite a ways.
Yes.
Mm. And you've been able to trace it back how far, you think?
In that particular area?
Mm-hmm.
Well over 30 years.
I mean, could it go
right
back?
Right in that one particular isolated area. But then from the area I was researching in Frayntown, I went back. And I found out that there was a story that happened about 15 miles away, northeast of Frayntown, and it was the Flatwoods Monster incident that happened September 12, 52.
And that's what's got you started on this long, long journey.
Yes, it started out on UFO and crop circle research in Braxton County. Then somebody had told me about maybe you should look into this incident, which I had no idea what it was all about. So I did a little historical research. research into it. I tried getting some of the locals to talk about it, and I was pretty well shut down. They just didn't want to talk mm-hmm. about it. And then several years later, I found out why, because the people were ridiculed over this story, and they were made fun of for 40 years.
So nobody wanted to come forward. And how did you win them over?
I started doing some research through the Project Blue Book documents and started going through the local newspapers, county newspapers, major newspapers, New York Times, different Boston papers, major cities throughout Baltimore. And what nobody had ever done before was look outside of Braxton County to see what was going on that particular night on September 1252. And I was able to, after several years, piece all of these different isolated incidents around the country. And there was actually over 204 locations where UFOs were seen, over 21 hours of sustained sightings up and down the eastern seaboard. So Flatwoods was not an isolated incident. It was basically the end of what happened. And I worked in reverse and plotted all these flight path trajectories throughout the United States.
So those that don't know anything about Flatwoods, if you missed the first interview, was this thing hit? Was this a craft that was hit? Or
there was actually several different crafts that came in over the eastern seaboard that particular night, and they were all damaged. They had pieces falling off of them. They
were making multiple
crash landings. And so we
scrambled some jets or some planes, and we were able to knock some of these out of the sky.
That's the logical explanation I could come up with, because I found out that in that same year, it was revealed by the Air Force that there were orders given to shoot flying saucers down. And let me give you a quote. It was actually, this hit the news wires on July 29th, 1952, and an Air Force spokesman, Lieutenant Monsell Montz, he was an information officer. He, quote, here's a quote, "The jet pilots are and have been under orders to investigate unidentified objects and to shoot them down if they can't talk them down."
Wow.
And then the article goes on to say, and I quote TJ, "In Air Force parlance, this means if a flying saucer refuses to land, jet pilots are authorized to shoot them down to Earth if they can get close enough to do so." So there were freestanding orders to shoot these things down out of the sky. Now, an important part of this whole picture, TJ, is 1952 was a record year for UFO reports. Mm-hmm. These reports were sent to Project Blue Book. And during the summer of 1952, which my book is focuses on, the Shoot 'Em Down book, June, July, August, and September, there were 1,134 reports sent to Project Blue Book, and there was 1,501 sent all year.
Wow.
So there was a lot of stuff going on.
A lot of things going on.
During that summer of 52. This wasn't a little isolated incident. There's a good track record.
Now, did you tell me this, that you thought part of it had to do because they buzzed the White House? I think people have heard about that.
Yes, that happened also in July.
And so that probably got the government quite upset, understandably.
Yeah, the UFOs were flying over the restricted areas of Washington, D.C.
The thing is, you know, I look at, you know, I believe that there's crafts out there right now, but there's no way, in my, you know, from what I understand of the craft that we see today, that we could even come close to knocking these things down. They are so much quicker, so much faster than what we have. Don't you think, the craft of today?
What I discovered through my research and working with different Air Force people and pilots and radar observers and so on, I work with a lot of different people on this. The one thing I didn't realize back in the earlier days until I started doing my research is in 1952, the United States Air Force had a couple different kinds of jets that had lethal rockets on them. They were FFARs. They were folding fin aerial rockets. And they were 2.75-inch rockets, and they had a 7.5-pound warhead. And these were, they traveled something like 3,700 yards, these particular rockets, and they went 2,500 feet per second, which is pretty quick. So I think that they gave them a good run for their money on this particular night on September 12th.
I guess my point was on that, that Frank, because this is you, we talked about this the last time. Doesn't the technology of these craft that they saw in the 50s that they ordered to shoot down, isn't that different from what we see today?
What do you mean, as far as maneuverability or different types of craft sighted?
Just from what you told me, it sounds like these were not as advanced.
Yes, and these crafts were like big and clumsy looking. They look like big giant ovals. And there's not too many seen like that now. Like the Flatwoods Monster ship was described as basically looking like the shape of an eggplant.
Yeah, I know. And you used to hear about those stories.
Yeah, they weren't. They, it seems they were able to maneuver as faster as well. I had a guy from the Air Force made a comparison. He says, well, if you have a Ferrari or a race car, he says, that can maneuver and it's very agile and it's a world record setter. He says, and now you take something like an 18-wheeler being drawn by a Mack truck. It's not going to be as quick as a Ferrari.
Probably.
You know, maybe these were cargo. We don't know what the heck they were. But they didn't seem to be as maneuverable. And these were the particular objects that were crashing around the United States that night.
One of them just happened to land in West Virginia in Flatwoods. They call it the Flatwoods Monster. That's how it all started. Frank, we're going to take a break. Frank Fascino. What is your website again, please?
It's flatwoodsmonster.com.
All right, back with Frank in just a moment.
Hi, this is Frank Fascino, Jr. I'm the Flatwoods Monster researcher, and you could find out more about my book, Shoot Them Down, The Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952, on my website, www.flatwoodsmonster.com.
It's out.
His name is Frank Fascino, Jr., and it's Flatwood Monster, flatwoodsmonster.com. He's followed this for a long time, 18 years. 18 years of your life, right, Frank?
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, I was going to ask you, because I was curious as to why we could shoot these down, and we couldn't shoot down, well, maybe we do, we just don't find out it. But why didn't these things ever come back? Now, you know a lot of investigators, right? You know the big guy, right?
Yeah, Stanton Friedman.
What did Stanton have to say about, because I was wondering, well, why don't these things come around anymore?
Well, the one thing I've talked about with Stanton over the years is that after this particular Flatwoods incident on September 12, 52, there wasn't too many UFOs seen around the world of these particular shapes. And Stanton came to the conclusion, well, if we were shooting at them, maybe they just decided not to come back anymore. They're kind of hostile there on Earth. Let's not go there anymore.
Yeah, and you would think that you would get the point, I would assume, if that you don't want to go back there. Probably not a good idea. That's the
somebody actually sent Stanton an email a couple of years back from Flatwoods. I don't know if we spoke about this on your first show, TJ, but somebody remembered as a kid that their mom was very aggravated because there, when the UFO flew over Flatwoods that night, it was going down the main interstate road. It was cutting in between the mountains and one of the nearby homes. Mom had out all the clothes drying. They're in 52. There were no dryers in Flatwoods. And the sparks and the little pieces that had flown off of the damaged craft actually went through and had seared and put holes through all the family's clothing on the line that night. But that was kind of interesting.
I remember you, I think you told me that one the last time. But then you started to do some more research and you've, like you said, you found out about that there was an executive order or an order, a military order to shoot these craft down.
Yes.
And you started this book, and this has been a project you've been working on for a long time, right?
Right, right.
You finally have things going on this. Now, you actually met the father of one of the pilots who, because I would guess we had some losses in that as well, right? We had some losses.
On that particular night, I discovered that there was an F-94B Starfire that disappeared into thin air on September 12th. 15th.
Thin air, completely gone.
Yeah.
They never found it.
And a radar net being tracked by several Air Force bases and radar installations along the coast, and it just vanished right off radar screens. There was no contact. Well, when I found out about the story, I started looking into it a little bit deeper, and I had contacted different government and Air Force facilities and places that hold records. And interestingly enough, there was no records of this particular incident on September 12, 52. As I started looking into Social Security death indexes, I looked through Project Blue Book, through all the intelligence reports called different places, these two men, which was the pilot and the radar observer, were never born, they never died, they were never in the Air Force. There was not one record on the planet to do with them. And I had actually written the United States Air Force, and I got documentation back saying, sorry, we have no record of this.
Mm. So they totally
covered it. After my first book came out, The Braxton County Monster, the documents were released. And what I did, TJ, is I took all the newspaper articles, because the press actually picked up on it. That's how I found out about it, through Associated Press articles. And it never hit major Northeast newspapers. It basically just stayed in the South. And I put together, by working with military people, I put together a timeline. And we figured out what the Air Force had said, and it couldn't have happened that way. So the accident reports from Norton Air Force Base were released. And the several-page report gave the version of what happened, which didn't match up what was originally stated to the press. So you have two different stories. Mm-hmm. So I combined every piece of information and spent years and reenacted this whole thing. I worked with Air Force people. I mean, dozens of people I work with behind the scenes. And we actually recreated and reenacted according to what the Air Force said had happened, and there's no way this could have happened. And I actually dedicate a couple chapters in the Shoot 'Em Down book. It was even to the point where I worked with a pilot, and he pulled up a couple chairs, and he sat in the pilot seat, and I sat in the radar observer seat, and we reenacted this thing according to the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how in-depth we got. We used maps and pinpointed and followed it step by step, and it was a complete abortion. There is no way this story happened according to what the Air Force said. And you'll read about that in-depth, step by step, all the comparisons, and we went through the whole story.
So you have a pretty good understanding of what actually went down.
Yes, and to this day, the plane has never been found. No wreckage. They did a search for thousands of square miles, and there was not one piece of wreckage found.
Now,
this happened over water.
This was not the only, I'm guessing this was not the only plane or jet to go down, I'm guessing, right?
On that particular night?
Yeah.
Well, here's what's interesting, TJ, is when I got the accident reports out, these government reports from that particular date, where this case was listed, the case before and the case after were actually yanked on the microfilm. There wasn't even an identifying identifying documentation. There was just nothing there. I was scrolling along the microfilm, turning.
Mm-hmm.
My case was in there. I found it. Then the cases before and after were gone. There's just nothing there. Mm-hmm. Just blank.
Totally removed.
Yeah, they were yanked and went to higher classification, which Stanton Friedman found very interesting.
You know, a lot of times people have told me that when you're on the right trail of the truth, and it doesn't always happen, but you seem to get validation, sometimes you get that. And,
right.
Things line up.
It's better just to withdraw the documents than to have to explain it.
Well, I'm saying, what I'm getting at is that you uncovered something you felt was the truth, and the weird coincidence about all of this is that how many years later was it you said one of the fathers, the father of a pilot.
Well, in this case, it was the brother. It was
brother.
The older brother. It was
older
his
brother.
Kid brother. And it was heartbreaking working with this guy.
But how did you meet that individual?
Pardon?
How did you meet him?
I tracked him down, and it turned out that he lives about an hour away from me.
When you moved all the way down, all the way down to Florida.
1,100 miles from Daytona Beach.
Yeah.
To Daytona Beach from Connecticut, and then I find out that this pilot who disappeared lived about a half an hour away from me.
His brother did.
Yeah, and his brother, the surviving family member, he's the one who received all the documents from General Chidlaw and the Air Defense Command. And he had actually saved all the Western Union telegrams. So now I had, at that point, I had the Western Union telegrams. I had all everything from the Air Force. I had all the newspaper articles. And I combined all this information together, and then I was told that the Air Force didn't have any records of this. Then, all of a sudden, after my first book came out stating all this information, the documents were released.
Mm.
And then I spent several more years, so I'm putting together, you know, the Western Union telegram information, what was released to the press in September, and then what was released officially. And all three versions were different.
But the brother of this pilot, they were lying to him too, weren't they? They were telling him that.
Yes, they were. And what was kind of interesting about that is September 12, 52, when the jet vanished into thin air, the family was not notified until Monday, which is a long time. Now put yourself in that shoes if you had a family member who disappeared on a Friday and the Air Force didn't contact you till 3 days later.
Hmm.
Kind of upsetting.
And they gave him a story that, what was the story that they, do you recall that or do you have that? Or?
Yeah, it's all in a book. I actually have verbatim type outs of the Air Force letters from Chidlaw and the different Air Force bases. And they really didn't have a hell of a lot to talk about because the jet just disappeared. But it was very vague, and they made it sound in the initial documentation like the plane was flying by itself, which it wasn't. It was flying with several other planes. You know, there was as little vague information given to them.
Now, you also, in this book, do you document crafts being fired on? Is there some kind of evidence that we were fired on or people talking about that at all?
What I did, TJ, this didn't seem to happen over the continental United States. There was three craft that flew in that night. And what I did is when I plotted the points, all it formed a triangulation that came off the eastern seaboard, up off the mid-Atlantic part of the United States. And that's where all my dots connected, which was in the Air Defense Identification Zone, which is the no-fly zone. All of these objects flew in and split and went in different directions. The first object flew down over the eastern seaboard, and it went southwest. And it was actually aiming and making a beeline shot right towards Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Mm.
The second UFO came in over the seaboard, and it flew northwest, and it was making a distinct direct shot for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And what's interesting is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, when you look on a map, is directly north of Oak Ridge, the way they were situated.
Hmm.
And then a third object came and split right down the middle, and that object flew over Washington, D.C. And this UFO was damaged, and on September 13th, the following day after the incident, the New York Times reported it as the flame over Washington.
Hmm.
And this object actually was flying at treetop level and flying under radar, which back at that point in 52, the capability of the radar systems were 5,000 feet and above. So anything under 5,000 feet, they had trouble picking up on radar. And that's back in that era, TJ, they had the Ground Observer Corps, who would sit in towers in different high buildings throughout the United States, and if they saw something, they would contact the Air Force.
We have to take a break, but we'll continue talking about this because it's really fascinating what you learn about something that probably 99.9% of us have never heard about, and it's all part of our history from the early 50s. Frank Fascino, Jr., our guest on Out There.
Out there.
Doesn't Frank sound like somebody from New Jersey or the Bronx or somewhere? He's got that accent going for him. I'll tell you, Frank's a really great guy, too. And I appreciate him taking time to get this on. We didn't get into everything we want to get into. There's about three more topics. One of them is, well, something that's a personal UFO encounter with him. And he tells actually how this came about. So we'll get to that in a different show. Also, I wanted to talk about somebody he met that claims that he knew there were alien bases on the moon. Kind of relates to the last show with David Twitchell. We're going to have to save that for our next time. And I'll get him back soon. And also, there's a third story about a really weird thing. So those things coming up soon. I'll have him back hopefully in a couple weeks. And you're listening to Out There. You found it at outthere.podbean.com if you got this as a download. Otherwise, feel free to leave a shout or a comment. And I thank you for listening.
It's Out There. Out there.
His name is Frank Frischino. My name is TJ Ryan. You're listening to Out There. This is a second performance. He's been on the show before. And it's good to have you back, Frank. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, TJ.
We're talking about these. I guess my question was is that there's probably no evidence to support that our planes were actually shot at, because that's probably all covered up, right?
No, absolutely.
But the number of disappearances, there's evidence of that, right?
Yeah, that's the disturbing part of what I started reviewing. What I actually did, TJ, is because it would take 10 lifetimes to go through all the accident reports that the Air Force had relayed and try to decipher and cut apart and try and figure out what was going on. What I did was an independent case study, and I used the New York Times newspaper as my source of information. And I spent a few years, I went through all the New York Times articles that had to do with fighter accidents. Okay, these were aircraft accidents where at least one aircraft was destroyed in each incident. And what I found out, TJ, is there was, according to the New York Times, between 1951 and 1956, the Times had reported 205 American fighter aircraft accidents. And these 205 accidents, there were actually 231 fighter planes were destroyed. Okay, out of those 231 fighters, 192 occurred over the United States.
Interesting.
That's a lot of planes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you put that into perspective? In today's era,
yeah,
if we had lost 192 planes in that time period. And what's interesting, out of those 192 that were destroyed over the United States, only seven of them were trainers. So now let's look at that statistic, 185 fighter aircraft destroyed over America that were non-trainers.
Mm.
And there were more than 200 pilots and radar observers were killed, and that includes vanished planes. Now, here's what's disturbing, TJ. Of these 205 accident reports in the Times, 26 American fighter jets vanished into thin air, okay? 19 over the United States and 7 vanished over foreign countries. None of them were over Korea during the time of the Korean War. And there were 35 pilots and radar observers that vanished over the United States.
That's interesting.
So now when you take into account these accidents and you tally it up, there was actually 42 American fighter pilots that vanished into thin air.
Hmm.
That's quite a few guys.
That is a lot. You know, and I was just thinking about this, and I know it was probably before, this was before the Flatwoods incident and all that, but what about those pilots that left Florida, Fort Lauderdale, was it? Remember the big...
Right, the Avengers.
Do you think, and just getting off the subject a little bit, do you think there was any kind of strange phenomena that happened to them? Or?
Well, the strange part of this whole thing is they vanished into thin air, too.
Yeah, do you think that maybe back then something else was going on, or did they just get lost? Or what's your feeling on that, Frank?
I don't know enough about the case, but I know nothing. I don't think there's ever been any debris found. This wasn't included in this because this happened at a different point.
Right. That was right after the war, World War II, when the Avengers disappeared.
Right. But But you do see a pattern. You know, there were a lot of planes that just vanished into thin air.
It was like five or six planes gone.
Right.
Just like that.
And what I found disturbing with my research of all of these accidents is the amount of guys who were combat veterans.
Hmm.
There were 20 fighter combat veterans who had fought in World War II and Korea or Korea. And these guys were amateurs. And these guys all died or vanished over the United States, too. 20 combat vets.
Yeah, that's
a lot of guys. I mean, you're talking, you know, guys who would just take off and minutes later they would vanish. Or they just happened to crash in some ridiculous accident, you know. And what I found interesting about this whole thing is, let me just give you an example. Nine of the top combat fighter pilots where these accidents had occurred over the United States, okay, I combined the top nine guys' information, and it comes out to a combination that were, these guys flew 885 combat missions during two wars, and they crashed or vanished over America during the shoot-down orders.
Yeah, what are the odds of that, huh?
885 combat missions, just with nine men, TJ.
Hmm.
You know, that's astronomical.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, what was going on here? There was no war. And this is what I talked about with Spreedman at length. I said, Stanton, there was no war going on. Why were these guys going on? He said, Frank, there was a war of a different kind going on.
Hmm.
There was a different enemy. These were UFOs.
How long did that war last, you think?
I went through the times from post-World War II all the way up to about 1960. And I found out, which I named my chapter, The Six Deadly Years, the high point was between 51 and 56.
So
that is when the most planes disappeared and or were crashing around the world. So, you know, 90% of them were over the United States. And what else is interesting, TJ, is out of these 205 accidents, there were 64 incidents where the pilots did not bail out, which is very disturbing. And I've talked with Air Force guys and, you know, all aspects of, you know, pilots, radar operators, air traffic controllers, mechanics. And when I showed them those statistics, their jaws hit the ground.
Really?
Because that's very unusual. So 64 incidents out of 205, the guys just went straight into the ground in the water and died, and there was no attempt to bail out of their crafts.
But yet no debris was ever found, right?
In several of the cases, right. Yeah, out of those vanished cases, there was nothing ever found.
And nobody ejected out. And I'm guessing, I mean, I don't know the protocol, but at some point you're getting out of that jet.
Exactly. And when I talked to Stanton about this, he says, Frank, maybe these guys were dead or they were unconscious before they hit the ground.
Mm-hmm. You know, something fired back at them.
UFOs have some type of mechanism where they could shut the system down on a jet and shut the electrical systems down, and they could shock a human into unconsciousness. Maybe this is one reason why these poor guys didn't attempt to bail out.
There's so much. There's just so much. And the thing is, what I love about, you know, what you've written about, this is something most of us have heard about. You know, we've heard about other incidents, but this is an incident that 99% of us never have heard about.
Mm-hmm.
It's been hidden away. And it was so huge. It was a big event.
Yeah, it was. There was thousands of people that saw these UFOs that night. But what it was is nobody ever pieced it together. The media is not like it is today. You know, television wasn't very big back then. To give you an idea, in Flatwoods, there was one or two television sets in the whole county. And they didn't work half the time because of the snow on the screen, if you remember those
days.
Because they're up in a mountain, so more than half of the time.
Now, let me ask you this.
Anything anyway.
Frank, do you think that the media has been told not to talk about these things, the media of today?
I think so, and I think this is ongoing all the way back into the 50s. I actually met a fellow in Charleston who had bought my book, and we were talking about it. And he told me that he worked at a radio station in West Virginia back during that era, and, you know, when everything was going on. And he said that he had heard from different guys in different radio stations that they were contacted and told not to talk about this.
I've heard that, too. I've heard that from other people that worked in the media. Somebody was telling me about a story about a person that was pretty high up at a network, had received information about UFOs, and they were told that was one of a couple of things they were not allowed to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And this was on the night of the Flatwoods, or they would be told that they would be shut down.
You know, it's unfortunate we're running out of time here, because Frank has a really good story. It's a really good story. I don't know if you want me to kind of lead into it, because we can save it for next time. We're almost out of time. Something very unusual. I mean, obviously the UFO phenomena, pretty unusual, right? The Flatwoods monster, which everybody thought was a monster, really was like a UFO and a being. But you told me something about when you were down in West Virginia at a place in Somersville, and I guess we'll have to save it, right? Pretty unusual event?
Yeah, it was a Birdman sighting took place up in the Wheeling, West Virginia area.
Isn't that
back
something?
In the 70s.
So here I have a gal on not long ago on one of my shows talking about these strange creatures that people have seen, and just out of the blue, you start telling me about that. So we're going to have to save that for another time.
Okay.
If you don't mind coming back on again.
Not at all. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. We're just touching the tip of the iceberg on this.
Yes, there is. And he spent a good part of his life doing it, the research. How many people are dedicated to, maybe you just get bit by a bug and you can't stop, right? It's almost an obsession.
Yeah, you just keep following the trail.
Well, thank you so much. Frank Fascino Jr., his website is flatwoodsmonster.com. Thank you, Frank.
Thanks for having me on, TJ.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.
Well, if you were one of the first five people or six or whatever it was that downloaded this or clicked on the site, then you heard me screw up. I don't like to screw up. I'm not trying to, but I do sometimes. So what are you going to do? I'm going to play this. I edit it down now because I was in a rush yesterday when I put it up there. I edited it down, but I did save the part where I screwed up. This is me and Frank just BSing part of our show. Sorry, Frank, if I sound like an idiot, but I don't know.
I never read your book. We're picking up speed.
I never read your book, and I didn't. I thought you told me that there was some kind of evidence that that we were fired upon, or did you find out anything about that? Or
that we were fired upon?
That jets were blown apart, or
what I found out was all the missing pilots that happened back then.
So you never really found out any kind of information as to actually being fired upon?
No.
Okay.
No, because UFOs don't exist.
Right. Well, I thought maybe you talked to somebody that knew somebody that relayed something like that.
Well, what I did is, what we can go into next is how many jets and planes vanished over the United States.
Okay.
Yeah, let me grab my note here on that, because this is a kick-ass part. This really is what gets everybody fired up.
Okay.
Okay, it's the accidents. The accidents and vanished planes that occurred during that era.
Which the military loves you, don't they?
Oh, yeah.